Our gospel lesson is from John chapter 13, verses 1 through 17. Before the festival of Passover, Jesus knew that his time had come to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them fully. Jesus and his disciples were sharing the evening meal. The devil had already provoked Judas, Simon Iscariot's son, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew the Father had given everything into his hands and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the table and took off his robes. Picking up a linen towel, he tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a wash basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with the towel he was wearing. When Jesus came to Simon Peter, Peter said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You don't understand what I'm doing now, but you will understand later." "No," Peter said, "you will never wash my feet." Jesus replied, "Unless I wash you, you won't have a place with me." Simon Peter said, "Lord, not only my feet, but also my hands and my head." Jesus responded, "Those who have bathed need only to have their feet washed, because they are completely clean. You disciples are clean, but not every one of you." He knew who would betray him. That's why he said, "Not every one of you is clean." After he washed the disciples' feet, he put on his robes and returned to his place at the table. He said to them, "Do you know what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you speak correctly because I am. If I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you too must wash each other's feet. I have given you an example. Just as I have done, you also must do. I assure you, servants aren't greater than their master, nor are those who are sent greater than the one who sent them. Since you know these things, you will be happy if you do them." The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I had a great grandfather who was a primitive Baptist. And primitive Baptists use that word primitive to mean original. They believe that their worship rituals and doctrine reflect that of the New Testament church or original church. And so they call themselves primitive Baptist. And one of the distinguishing characteristics of the primitive Baptist is that in addition to communion, they also have a regular foot washing. And so they would often have a Friday night worship service that included both communion and foot washing. The men and women would separate and they would each do the foot washing separately. And the story that I've heard passed down is that my grandfather and his two younger brothers, my great uncles, would occasionally play pranks on each other when it came time to go to the foot washing service, such as like putting an egg in the boot of someone's shoe, or in the heel of someone's shoe, and then stepping on the egg. They'd have no choice but to go to church because it was their only dress shoe, and so they would show up for the foot washing service quite literally with egg on their feet. I think that may have only happened once because my great-grandfather was not impressed. Now, when my great-grandfather died, his widow, my great-grandmother, announced that she was returning to the Presbyterian church of her youth. No more foot washing for her. From then on, she would go back to a Presbyterian church where they would have a quarterly communion service that was done decently and in order. And she made her children promise that they would always be Presbyterian. Now, through the years, I've always been struck by the widely divergent reactions to foot washing in worship. Before the children's time this morning, one of the kids, and I won't say which one, actually pointed to the bowl quietly and asked, "We're not doing that, are we?" And it's interesting to me, like I remember doing foot washings in youth group where there was perhaps a greater enthusiasm for foot washing because everyone had young, beautiful feet. It was part of an experience. But then as we get older, many of us get more self-conscious about our feet. Some of us don't even wear sandals during the summer. And so we're perhaps less enthusiastic about foot washing in general. I may be fearfully and wonderfully made, as Psalm 139 puts it, but please don't touch my feet. And perhaps I can relieve some anxiety this morning by saying that the basin and towel that you, and stool that you see here are largely symbolic. We won't do a foot washing in this particular worship service. So in true Presbyterian fashion, I'm going to invite us to think about foot washing. Now, as I mentioned with the kids, the usual custom in Jesus' time was that the guests would wash their own feet. The host would give them a basin and a towel for them to do that. In wealthier households, a female slave might be given the task of washing the guest's feet. So we can imagine how shocked the disciples were when Jesus took the basin and towel and began to wash their feet. Now, what would be the equivalent today? During the pandemic, you know, pastors and worship leaders, you know, may have held out a Purell dispenser as people came in so they could rub their hands with antibacterial foam. Maybe something like that, but that's not quite as intimate. Maybe something would be more like it would be if your pastor offered to give you a manicure or a pedicure. That would be more shocking, and most of you would probably react like St. Peter, like, no, no, Pastor Jack, you're not giving me a mani-pedi. No. And please don't worry, I'm not going to try that. I'm simply trying to brainstorm about 21st century equivalents to foot washing. But more than the foot washing itself, what was really shocking to the disciples was Jesus taking that role of a slave. Jesus removed the outer robe, symbolically stripping himself of status, and wrapped a towel around his waist, and used that towel to wipe the disciples' feet, completely subverting their ideas of status and privilege. Now, foot washing may be something from the past, but status and privilege at dinner parties is something that is still with us. Who gets to sit next to whom? Does a 12-year-old get to sit at the grown-up table or the children's table at Thanksgiving? If the dinner is in a restaurant, who gets to sit at the good tables? And who gets stuck next to the kitchen? If it's a banquet and there's going to be a head table, well, who sits at that? And if it's a really big affair, there might even be an A-list and a B-list. When I was in college, I had the opportunity to be a summer intern in the U.S. Senate. And I worked in the office of U.S. Senator Lloyd Benson from Texas. And there was a day when the senator took all the interns out to lunch. There were 8 of us. And I'm embarrassed to say that when we got to the table where the senator was hosting us, it kind of became like a game of musical chairs, where like everyone tried to grab the chair that was closest to the senator. You know, even though the chairs that were further away from the senator were still within eyeshot of the senator, still within earshot, but nonetheless, there we were, kind of like jockeying for position on this day when the senator took the interns to lunch. And some of us may care more about status and privilege than others, but no one, probably, is free from anxiety at some level about having a place at the table. And so we're apt to make up rules so that we can be assured of our place. And these rules are usually unwritten, and newcomers are left to discover them the hard way. Most church communities are welcomed and very well-intentioned about their welcome, but there still may be groups of insiders who know more and those who perhaps haven't been around as much. There can be subtle ways in which status and privilege get played out that we're not quite aware of. For instance, I'm wearing a pulpit robe, and I was taught that the robe that I wear is not meant to confer any kind of like clerical or priestly status, but instead, in our Reformed tradition, it's a symbol of education. But the problem there is that education itself is often a matter of status and privilege. And I may encourage people to call me Pastor Jack, and I do, instead of Reverend Dr. Cabanis. But the doctoral stripes are still here if you want to notice. And so what does it mean for us, really, to lay aside notions of status and privilege? What does it mean for me to take off the outer robe and wrap a towel around my waist and get to work? The New Testament scholar N.T. Wright actually discourages pastors and other church leaders from being the one who wash feet if you have a foot washing service. And why would that be? Because there's this sense, perhaps, that the pastor or church leaders stand in the role of Jesus. And when we deliberately invert status, even that can have a way of reinforcing status. I remember being moved when Pope Francis first became pope, and he did the annual foot washing by visiting a prison, and he washed the feet of prisoners. But what happened right after that? Pope Francis went right back to being pope. The prisoners went right back to being incarcerated. The status was still there. It was just temporarily flipped during a foot washing ceremony. And I also remember I was very moved when in the early 90s, you might remember this story, but a Jordanian guard on the West Bank side of the border fired onto the Israeli side, killing an Israeli soldier. And King Hussein traveled to Israel, visited the family of the soldier who had been killed, got down on his knees, and begged forgiveness from that family. I've never forgotten that. And how I wish that now, in the midst of the uncertainty with the Middle East, with the conflict between Iran and the United States and Israel, not knowing at all how this will play out, not knowing where the repercussions and attacks will come, how I wish at this moment we had leaders in the Middle East who exhibited that kind of humility and grace. Then we might be hopeful, more hopeful, for the prospects for peace. But even then, with that remarkable moving gesture from King Hussein, what happened next was that King Hussein traveled back to Amman, Jordan, and continued being king. What Jesus is really trying to get us to do is not to trade places in terms of our status and privilege. Jesus is inviting us to get rid of it entirely, to put it out of our minds, and instead to treat each other as friends. Jesus says later in chapter 15, "If you do my will and follow my teachings, you're my friends." And also Jesus says, "No greater love than this exist, that someone lay down their lives for their friend." And this might happen all at once in the example of someone giving their lives on the line of duty or a first responder putting their own lives in danger. For most of us, it happens by giving our way our lives a little bit or a lot at time throughout the course of a lifetime. But Jesus invites us to be friends who love and serve each other without asking, "What's in it for me?" Jesus invites us to be friends by us reaching out to outsiders, to those who may or may not normally frequent a worship service. Jesus invites us to do away with status and privilege and to remember that each and every face we see is the face of a child of God, period, end of sentence. What does it mean for us in our own time to risk vulnerability, not only in washing someone's feet or doing some act of service for them, but what for us might be an even more vulnerable act, letting someone else wash our feet or take care of us in some way when we would rather be self-sufficient? One way or another, we are all in need of washing, of being washed. One way or another, we need Jesus to cleanse us of all our pretensions. We need reminding that when we gather together for worship, that we are not divided into an A list and a B list, but we are all friends gathered around this table. It's one table, one gift, one Lord, one faith, one baptism. And we have these words of Jesus as a final reminder. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. All glory and praise be to our God. Amen.